Okay, we'll call to order the House Revenue Committee. We are lacking a quorum as we speak, so we will consider ourselves a subcommittee of the committee until we get our fifth member. But of course, this is for public testimony today only. We're only in public hearing. We're not going into work session. We have just one bill on the agenda, so we will get started and begin with an overview from Lizbeth, and then take up Jim Maneri to give us something more of an overview with your low-tech visual aids. We're used to PowerPoint in here. At least it's not a film script. Okay. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2778, and Lizbeth.
Chairman and committee members, with House Bill 2778 is exempting the federal communications licenses, the FCC licenses, from property taxation, and applies to taxpayers beginning on or after July 1st of 2001. Now, to give you a little bit of background on this, there's an extreme amount of history that is entailed with this particular bill, as well as others we've heard in the past. And under current law, centrally assessed utilities are valued for property tax purposes by the Department of Revenue, and they use several different appraisal methods, income, cost, and market. And certain appraisal methods can capture the value of intangibles for certain utilities. So the intangible property, just to give you kind of a basic definition, is an economic resource, but it has no physical presence. So one example of an intangible is these Federal Communications Commissions, these FCC licenses, and there are others, and they are listed in ORS 307-020. So during the 97 session, both the House and the Senate passed House Bill 2062, which exempted from taxation the intangible values for centrally assessed utility companies. The governor vetoed that bill in 97 and asked for an interim group then to work to discuss the intangible exemptions for centrally assessed utilities. So through that interim work discussions prior to the 99 session, there were several areas of agreement and disagreement between utility industries and the Department of Revenue. And they identified how these intangibles are currently being taxed and how to remove any intangible value from centrally assessed utility valuation. So last session in 99, we had House Bill 2050, which passed both houses, but it was vetoed by the governor, and it would have removed most intangibles from centrally assessed utilities, but there was still some disagreement on the method of removing particular utilities' intangible value. During the 99 session, we also heard the House pass Senate Bill 559, but it was not signed by the Speaker of the House and the Senate President, and that would have just exempted FCC licenses from valuation of centrally assessed wireless utilities. So that Senate Bill 559 was exactly the same as what you're seeing now here in 2001 in House Bill 2778. And just to recall people's memory, too, what we had with the 99 session is we had House Bill 2039, and what this did was pass, which calls for state funds to reimburse counties for new property tax expenditures after July 1st of 2001. And if there was money that is appropriated to this property tax expenditure fund, then local districts shall be reimbursed by the state for 50% of those new property tax expenditures. So this is the type of bill that would apply to that bill that was passed last session. So to just what I've given you is a breakdown of the revenue impact by county for 2001-02 through 2004-05. The first four columns are giving the estimated tax on the FCC licenses, and this is the total tax amount. And then the last four columns are that are shaded the gray are for school taxes. But basically, it's about $2.1 million in 2001-02, $2.4 in 2002-03, and $2.6 and then $2.9 in the outer biennium. And what we see is that mainly about nearly 50% of that value is coming from Multnomah County. And then you're seeing about when you add in like Clackamas and Lane and Washington and Marion, then you have over 70% of that value then each year. So the majority of this wireless valuation is in kind of the larger metro areas. And we see that about 40% of the local revenues each biennium are going to be for schools. So schools in the first biennium would be about $1.7 million reduction from removing these FCC licenses in 2001-03 at about $2.1 million in the 2003-05 biennium. So these estimates have been based on Department of Revenue has recently done a survey and gone through their centrally assessed role and looked at the FCC licenses and what is the value of those. And so they will be discussing with you about those calculations. And this is a slight change from last session when we had Senate Bill 559 and the revenue impact for that.
Okay. Thank you very much. Jim, let's bring you on up to finish the overview. As I understand, the revenue impact numbers came from your shop as well. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, yes, we provided the value information. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Maneri of the Department of Revenue. With me is Eric Smith, who is far more knowledgeable than I am in sort of the mechanics of how we do values. I have a handout. What I've been asked to do is just give you a brief background on the intangible issue, and then I'm going to end up with trying to explain, because people want to know, why from last session to this session the amount of assessed value coming off the roll had quadrupled. So I'm going to attempt to explain sort of what happened with Measure 50. First of all, just a quick background. I'm going to go back to the turn of the century in 1900 just to say that at that time, our property tax taxed all property for individuals, for businesses. The tax was on all property, living intangible. That would mean for an individual. The county assessor was supposed to go out and not only figure out your house, but also if you had any contracts or mortgages or stock or anything else of value, then that was supposed to be taxed. And that was not an easy task at that level. So the other thing that was happening at that time was the nationally was the large trusts, J.P. Morgan and the banks, Pullman, the railroads, Rockefeller and Standard Oil, and there was a movement in the country, the populist movement grew up, sort of opposing these huge economic concentrations of wealth. So what happened is, the turn of the century, one thing that developed was states created public utility commissions to regulate those kind of industries. And the other thing that happened was, in about the 1930s, at least in Oregon, and this is similar in other states, the state decided to not tax, for property tax purposes, intangibles of individuals and other businesses, but it kept the tax on centrally assessed type properties. And so we've actually had this policy for about 70 years, 65 years. It's moved forward. And so for these kind of properties, we use a different kind of valuation method than most. And to give you an idea, if we're going to go out and put a value on, say, a sawmill of a wood products company, we go out and deal with that sawmill in that location. We don't deal with that company's entire value. And there's information available to try to do that, to put a value just on that piece of property. For centrally assessed type properties, which is telecommunications, electrics, railroads and airlines, the method of valuation, and this has been pretty much is done everywhere this way, is to try to determine the value of the entire system and then allocate something to the state. So for instance, if you have a railroad running through, say, a dozen states, then the common appraisal method is to figure out the value of the entire railroad and then figure out how much of that is attributable to your state. And that methodology has been used for decades. It's common. So it is a little different methodology. So anyway, in the 1930s, the policy changed on intangibles for other kind of properties. And then I'll jump to the 1990s now. The a number of the industries that are centrally assessed were going through change with deregulation and other things, and they basically said they were going to put in a bill to exempt their intangibles along with everybody else. And in fact, in the 95 session, we had a bill toward the end that was gut and stuffed, and the bill, and this is on all the intangibles, the bill died on the House floor the last night of the session. And the industry talked to us after that and said we intend to put a bill in for the 97 session. And so we work with the industry to try to develop data and techniques to try to extract the value of intangibles if the legislature was going to provide the exemption. That bill then in the 97 session, actually there were, in regard to this, there were two bills. There was the large intangibles bill. There was also an FCC license bill. They were both here in the House Revenue Committee to begin. The larger intangible bill was passed, passed on the floor, was passed on the Senate side, and the governor vetoed it. The FCC license bill stayed in this committee. Then in the 97 session, we ended up with two bills, in the 99 session, I'm sorry. Ended up with the two bills, and the intangibles bills came out of the House Revenue Committee, went to the Senate side and passed, and then toward the end of the session, the governor indicated that he would veto that big intangibles bill, but he would probably sign the small FCC license bill. And so this committee moved out the license bill, and it passed over to the Senate side, and this is right toward the end of the session, and the bill did not come out of the Senate Revenue Committee, and the bigger intangibles bill went to the governor's desk, and he vetoed it. And that's just sort of the legislative history. And let me just say that around that bill, especially the big intangibles bill, the arguments were, why is this industry being treated differently than others? There was certainly concern by schools and districts of the impact on them of the loss of revenue to provide services. And then our only issue was around trying to figure out how to identify these intangibles if you were to pass the exemption. And that is, I will say, is sort of intangibles for the kind you're looking at. They do go from anything from an FCC license to goodwill, and trying to determine the goodwill of a company. It's just the data is just not really clean to do it.
So. Jim, you're talking about the difficulty in identifying the intangibles in the context of the bigger intangibles.
Yeah. I'm sorry, yes, yeah. Mr. Chair. In the bigger bill, it's sort of the range. It's intangibles, contracts, FCC licenses. And so we've always tried to work with industry to try to figure that out. Then let me say just a little about the FCC licenses, and that is in the 90s, I think it was in 94, Congress sort of changed the rules on licenses. Before then, if you were a company and wanted to get an FCC, a federal communications license, then you went through a process and applied, and if it was granted, your only expense was whatever it cost you to go through the process. There was nothing you paid specifically for the license. Congress changed the rules and said we want them to go out to bid. And so the FCC set up auctions, bid auctions on the licenses through a series of blocks. And suddenly we had an interesting situation of what the bidding would be on these licenses. I must say, from what little I know and had looked at the numbers a couple of years ago, you had bids that were... where one company would win a bid for $35 million for the entire state of Oregon, and another state bid $100 million primarily for the city of Portland and some outlying areas. I do believe the company that bid $100 million has since gone bankrupt, but this was a very dramatic change in the industry in terms of the licenses and the deregulation. And so, in an appraisal sense, put a value on them, it was, there were a lot of indicators all over what they might be worth. And companies had different values on their books, too. So So last session, as we looked at the numbers, we did the best we could to put a value on the license piece, and that number was used for the revenue impact last session, and we also had Measure 50 come into play in the meantime. So I'll do the little slides. I've got four slides, and three of them are sort of a quick introduction to Measure 50, if you haven't seen this, and then I'll get to the license slot.
Okay, Measure 50 was really a model to deal with the rise in value of houses in the 90s. Oregon was experiencing a lot of in-migration and jobs, and so it just pushed the housing market up. There were subdivisions building all over. So values were going up 10, 20, 30% in a year. And so part of the drive for Measure 50 was to try to put a limit on how much you can increase a homeowner's tax, especially given this climate. The basic measure came out and was saying you shouldn't have, from year to year, normally you shouldn't have to pay more than 3% increase in tax, because that was sort of the cost of living index. That was sort of the theory behind it. But it really was built on a house model. So, in the example, if you were at $100 for your value, and it's going up at 10% a year or whatever, the idea of Measure 50 was to say, we're going to put in a lid on that. So if you're growing above this lid, you're only going to be taxed on where that limit is. It's an upper limit. So in this case, as long as that limit is below the blue line, that's where your tax will be, your assessed value. And that was sort of the theory of it. And as you can see, the limit then is only allowed to increase 3% a year, even though the value of your house is going up much faster. Another part of this was what happens if someone adds on to their house. So you have a $200,000 house and you put on a $100,000 addition. What Measure 50 said, which we recreated, 47, was, well, it's really not the same house as it used to be, so we will adjust, the limit is adjusted then for the addition. So in this case, it was going up at 3%, but when you put the addition on, not only did that increase the market value of your house, but it also pushed up the lid on how much your assessed value could be. Now for businesses, which this model didn't anticipate, businesses have depreciating assets, they have equipment and things they're retiring every year, so they've got things that affect their value in a downward way, and in addition, they are, in any particular year, they're usually adding new equipment and new property, so they're sort of balancing it, whereas normally houses aren't. So generally what happens, this is just generally what happens if you look over the long run, on a lot of the companies, is that their the amount of their depreciation plus the property they're retiring tends to offset the amount of new property they bring on, and so over the long run, their market value tends to be fairly stable. You don't see huge swings in it. So you take this model very generally, and you go, well, what you're going to see over time is the Measure 50 limit will gradually increase, because when they bring on a new property, it allows the limit to bump up, but the market value tends to stay down fairly level. And this will be different for different circumstances, but generally, this is what was happening. So what it meant for a lot of business properties, their assessed value was their market value, not the limit, because they were below it, and the Measure 50 says that if you're below the limit on your market, that's where your tax is. It's the lower of the two, either the calculated limit or your actual market value. So that takes us to licenses. And as best as I can explain, we're getting to what happened since the last session in terms of this estimate of value. 2 years ago, with the data we had, Our best guess was putting values on the licenses that were, in effect, less than what we know today. So we had, in that sense, lower values, and we were at a point on the measure 50 where that gap between the limit and the actual market value was fairly small. Now, it didn't make any difference. So 2 years ago, I'm just going to say, if you say that the value of licenses was $5, and your market value was $100, if there were an exemption, then that would reduce it down to $95, if that property was exempt. And because you're below the limit, it won't make a difference. It's the full $5 million. That's what taxes would be lost. But in the last 2 years, given a lot more information we have, those licenses, or the apparent value of those licenses, has gone up dramatically. There's more data about it. There's more that's happened. I recall there's one transaction where one company was buying the license and the towers and everything from another company, a big multi-million-dollar transaction, and they allocated about 70% of the value of that transaction to the license. Now, with what little I know about these kind of businesses, there's some logic to that, because the tangible property you have in this license as you build the towers, at some point, if you're under the capacity of that system, you're just going to keep adding customers, and the tangible property isn't going to change that much. So the value there is much more in the business than it is in the tangible assets. But that's, again, sort of what appears to be happening in general. So when we went to do the numbers for this last year, the licenses as a part of the whole dramatically shot out. And when that happened in this thing, it pulled up a lot of the values up above the limit for companies. So in this example, given that, if your total value goes from 100 to 150 because of the license, in this case, it shows, normally that would add $50 million, or $50 in this case, of value to the roll, but with measure 50, it's stopped at 20. And so basically that's all you would capture under the current law, is that $20 of value, not 50, because measure 50 stops it. And so that was what the tax would be based on. So now if you create the exemption, then the loss is the $20 of that. And so when you look at the analysis done 2 years ago, the quadrupling is basically because of what's happened with measure 50 and the huge acceleration of what we know about the values of the licenses. And that's, as we've looked at the figures and analyzed it, that's what we think has happened in terms of the analysis, that the assessed value on loss has gone about four times 2 years ago. And those are sort of the factors of why that's happened. And this is very general, again, it's very general, depends on which, you can look at different companies in the big group, and you may have a different result, but generally this is what we think is happening.
Mr. Smith? Are you going to add anything more? Jim, are you done?
I'm basically here to field questions if they're of a technical nature.
Questions for either of these gentlemen?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Witt.
This issue of being able to determine the intangible value that would have to be backed out of the equation to determine what is taxed, I remember this discussion 2 years ago, and what I was didn't quite understand is why couldn't you just determine the value of the tangible assets as a method of subtracting out the intangible? Doesn't that get you to the same answer? I'm not just talking about FCC licenses here, obviously. I'm talking about all intangibles.
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, The difficulty comes is in valuing a centrally assessed company, is that you're looking at different indicators to get your value. One is to look at cost, which is oftentimes looking at sort of what's on the books. You're also looking at income streams, and the income stream represents all the assets. And you're also looking at if there's comparable market activity, and you also look at sometimes balance sheet indication. But all I can say is that in some ways it gets merged in with the value, and it's difficult to extract, especially if you use like an income approach.
Follow up.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it true that your values, you're going to have tangible assets that have a value, and then you're going to have intangible values that have a value? There's nothing else, correct?
That's correct.
All right. So if you were going to exempt all of the intangible asset value, wouldn't the correct way to do that is simply go in and assist the tangible asset value?
I'm going to let Eric talk and take
it. Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, the challenge as an appraiser is if you were to do one approach, for example, a cost approach where you could go out and figure out what it would cost to, for example, in the railroad, put down the railroad ties and to build the switching yards and to buy the locomotives, and that's it, you could do that. But these properties are actually income-producing properties, and so as an appraiser, one of the important tools that we use in our tool bag, if you will, is an income approach, so that we can see how much income are these properties generating. And in the income approach, you can isolate for every dollar of revenue how much dollar was generated because of the railroad tie and the track, and how much of that dollar was generated because they have a name that's been around a long time or goodwill. And that's the challenge when you're trying to pull intangible values out of these properties. So I don't know if that answers your
question. No, I don't think it does. I mean, I appreciate that you're trying to answer it, but maybe I'm not explaining it clearly enough. Other businesses that are on centrally assessed utilities do not pay a tax on intangibles. So what you do is you look at their tangible assets that are subject to tax, and you have a basis of determining the value of that to base the tax on. That being the case, if you're going to pull out all of the intangible and the value of all the intangible assets out of the equation, rather than trying to determine the value of the intangible assets, wouldn't you simply go and determine the value of the tangible assets in the same way that you do for businesses today that only pay a personal property tax on their tangible assets?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, that if you're doing the sawmill example, for example, that Mr. Mineri talked about, when you go to look at the pieces of that sawmill, there's a ready market for those pieces of that sawmill. And so if you're buying and selling those pieces, we can go and go to that sawmill and determine a market for those pieces. The challenge for these centrally assessed properties is the typical marketplace for them is they're buying and selling as a whole unit. You're buying or selling the whole railroad. You're not buying 100 yards or 100 miles of track. You're buying the whole railroad. There are some anomalies where somebody will buy a portion of a phone company or a portion of a railroad company, but as Mr. Mineri stated, the 36 states in the country that use unitary valuation in order to determine the value for these companies do so because that's, we believe, the appropriate method to capture the true value of those companies. First, you value them at the unit that they're bought and sold at, the level that they're traded, the unit, and then figure out what their value is in Oregon. It's not to say that it would be impossible to try and do something you're doing, but it's a completely different market to try and figure out how many telephone poles there are, what their value is, because that's not what buyers and sellers do in the marketplace to determine the value of those assets. They're buying the whole company that's operating those.
And is it part of it, too, at least in this bill, this is not an exemption as to all, I mean, this is the narrow exemption. You're only exempting the FCC licenses, and so you still have in that calculus of the value of the assets those other intangibles.
Correct.
Mr. Chair, again, Jim Mineri for the record. I guess I would say to Representative Witt's question, if you had good data, that would be true. That in appraisal, the basic theory says is that all the approaches ought to show you the same number because the market value is the market value. And the problem you have at times in using any particular approach is how good the data is. So Back in the 80s, we got into litigation with the railroads, and we were using the cost approach of what their book assets were worth, fundamentally. And the railroads' argument was that approach was, the way it was done, was inadequate because historically what had happened was the railroads obviously physically built out in this country to that world, and then the world changed, and now they have physical assets that necessarily don't serve well their business, but it's there. So they were arguing that there was a great deal of obsolescence in the physical part of the railroad, and so we've been using more of an income approach on them, and it gets down to the data. They were arguing that our data wasn't sufficient to try to get the real value. So it may depend a little different from one industry to the next or a company to the next on whether you could actually just go in and pull out the tangible, identify it, and have the answer.
All right, anything else? Representative Bates.
Most of us were not here 2 years ago at this committee, and this is a sort of new ground we're plowing. Why is one small segment of intangible taxation pulled out? Apparently governor was in favor of that, but not the rest of them. I don't quite understand the reasoning there, why one section is different than the others if you're trying to tax intangible things.
Mr. Chair, I really can't speak on behalf of the governor's office, but I think, I really shouldn't. There were arguments both ways on the bigger bill in terms of all the intangibles.
I'll bet we'll get some testimony on that.
The governor made a call on it.
Let's put the paint off to later.
Sneak preview. Anything else? Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Invite up then Gary Conklin and Stacy. Gary, come on up. I can't tell what's attached to what. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I know why you didn't recognize me, because I'm in a different outfit.
You're not wearing your red sweater.
Well, that's right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for noting that. That's why I'm inconspicuously hiding in my blue blazer. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Gary Conkling, here today representing VoiceStream and testifying on behalf of wireless phone companies with Oregon Markets. And the wireless companies that serve Oregon support passage of House Bill 2778. And I'll try to be brief, but just for the record, would like to put a little bit of background information about FCC licenses for the wireless industry on the record. As has been noted by previous witnesses, the tax treatment of FCC licenses for wireless phone companies has been tangled in the debate over taxation of intangible assets owned by centrally assessed utilities. Because wireless companies are grouped with centrally assessed utilities, even though they've never been regulated, as most centrally assessed utilities have, their FCC licenses are subject to taxation. Until 1994, the wireless communication industry consisted of two licensed cellular service providers in each licensed area across the country. These providers received their licenses through a lottery process at no cost. The FCC began auctioning personal communication services, or PCS, licenses in 1994, and as a result of these auctions, up to 7 PCS carriers may operate in each market. When you add in the cellular providers, you can see you have a number of service providers in any given marketplace, not an exclusive franchise holder. PCS auction winners paid substantial amounts to the FCC for their licenses, and for example, as was noted by Mr. Maneri, VoiceStream paid $35 million for its license to provide PCS service in Oregon. In addition, and maybe most important to obtaining their licenses, PCS companies have spent money to develop their underlying networks, which has resulted in millions of dollars of taxable capital investment in local communities. Because of the disparate acquisition values, FCC licenses can and have been taxed at varying levels. Prior to 1996, Oregon did not tax the intangible assets of cellular companies, and starting in 1996, Oregon began taxing the value of these licenses awarded to PCS providers. In response to legal action, the Department of Revenue entered into a settlement with wireless companies that placed a fraction of the acquisition value of FCC licenses on the tax rolls, and that settlement has subsequently expired. Taxation of FCC licenses held by wireless phone companies became an issue when United States Cellular proposed to build a call center in Medford. Governor Kitzhaber, in the negotiations involving that particular development, made a commitment that he has subsequently reaffirmed to support a tax exemption for wireless phone company or wireless phone company FCC licenses. As has been noted previously, exempting FCC licenses from taxation has been blocked the last two sessions by gubernatorial vetoes of broader measures dealing with intangible assets of centrally assessed utilities. And I might note that the wireless industry has participated in the coalitions to support the broader legislation. But regardless of merit, the political circumstances exist that will produce yet another veto of broader legislation dealing with intangible taxation for centrally assessed utilities. The only legislation the governor has said he will sign is an FCC license tax exemption bill. That's what House Bill 2778 is, and that's all it does. There are other industry sectors, including the telecommunications sector, that won't have their intangible tax issues addressed by this bill. And in fact, wireless companies have other intangible asset issues that won't be addressed either. But we've been on this road twice before. We know how it ends, and realistically, we're trying to get to a destination that's different than in the past. There's no more logic or strategy to our views about this bill than that. We also believe that House Bill 2778 on its own is correct tax policy. There are similar exemptions in California and Washington, and my colleague, who will speak in a moment, noted that Idaho and Montana also do not tax FCC licenses. Colorado is an interesting state that's currently having a debate about a broader intangibles issue. It does not, at the moment, tax FCC licenses. So there is precedent for this pattern, and we think it, in fact, is the correct tax policy. We urge adoption of 2778.
Questions? Mr. Conklin. Yes, Mr. Carlson.
Thank you. Mr. Conklin, I was looking at the revenue impact statements, and I know you and I share a concern for education. So could you comment on your feelings about this and the revenue impact and how that might reconcile in terms of what school districts would lose if this bill passes?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, you're correct. I not only share that interest, I represent school districts here and have been an advocate for school funding. It's always an awkward situation when you're dealing in an environment where you have budget situations to deal with tax-related matters that can have an impact on the property tax. The way you have to parse this issue, at least in my view, is to look at the merit of the tax policy consideration to see whether or not, in fact, it is meritorious. They do have impacts. Those impacts, while the legislature sits, can be addressed. This one would have an impact on the amount of money that local school districts collect. There's no question about that. But it's also something that you can address while you're here in the building.
Representative Vick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gary, does this bill in any way create an inequitable situation with regard to taxation of wireless companies and other telecommunications companies that are operating over lines?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Witt, an inequitable situation exists today. There are effectively telecommunications providers that do not have their intangible assets taxed. This bill will not correct all of the inequities, but it does deal with the tax policies reflecting FCC licenses, and it deals with, in effect, the inequity that we face with our sister states. So we have an inequity in the current situation between different providers. This won't solve it. I don't think it really makes it any worse.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. being from Medford and having the U.S. Cellular call center, there are now a lot of new employees with living wages going on. I think I kind of understand what happened. It's a little slow sometimes. The question I have is, you mentioned other states do not have intangible taxes on their FCC licenses. Do you know if the other intangible taxes we impose on businesses are also exempt in those states?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bates, if you might, I would defer to my colleague who probably is better able to answer that question than I am, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure.
And I'm sure she will answer the question.
Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Stacy Sprinkle, and I'm with Verizon Wireless. And to answer your question, of the 36 states that use the unit appraisal, as Eric alluded to, over half those states exempt intangible value. There is question as to what that intangible value is, which is probably the debate that's been held in Oregon over the last several years. But FCC licenses are either expressly exempt on their own or worked into a general intangibles debate. But over half the states currently have a much broader intangibles exemption than just isolating it to FCC licenses.
Representative Byrne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gary, can you tell me, in the bill that the governor's vetoed in the past because of some other intangible assets that were in there, what's the makeup of those assets? What were they?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brown, they involved a range of intangible assets, customer lists, goodwill, contracts, a variety of items of that type. FCC licenses were among the intangibles that are included. And Mr. Chair, if I might just add that there is an inequity that the entire centrally assessed community has addressed, and to some degree I probably should have referenced this in my response to Representative Witt. Centrally assessed utilities, including our industry, pay property tax on their intangible assets, where corporate taxpayers that are not centrally assessed utilities do not. And it is in that context that there are inequities within industry sectors and between sectors. So there's no question that there is an inequitable situation. I don't know that anybody really disagrees with that or disputes that. The question is there a path to pursue some reconciliation of those inequities that will go somewhere, as opposed to making us just feel better that we've got a bill that we're moving that we like. We would like to see broader issues resolved, but in all reality, they're not going to be resolved. And it's not a theory, it's not a prediction, it's a pretty clear tattoo that I'm wearing on my arm, just like some of my colleagues back here, because I worked with them to try to pass broader legislation. And you might pass it, but it isn't going to be in the law books. So to the extent that there is an inequity, I agree there is one. We can't fix it all. It's not in our power to fix it. All we can do is try to deal with the one inequity that we have that we can deal with.
Representative Brown, and this is good background information, but the statute that defines intangible personal property or intangibles is referenced in the staff measure summary, and it's ORS 307.020. And I won't go on about that, but it's worth looking at. It does include goodwill, customer lists, contract rights, patents, trademarks, copyrights, trade secrets, shares of stock in a corporation, those kinds of things. Yeah, but it's worth looking at if you want a broader background on just what else is included in intangible personal property. Representative Witt.
Yeah, thank you. Gary, back to this question of inequity. If this bill passed in its current form, doesn't it create a new inequity that doesn't exist today between wireless and wireline and the treatment of the value of a license?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Witt, I guess in my personal opinion, I don't think so. But I suppose I could understand why someone else might think so. So my answer is no.
Okay.
Ms. Brinkley, did you?
And if I can comment on that at this point, and I will address some of this and some of the other comments that I make, but The FCC wireless license presented a unique issue because of what Mr. Maneri and Mr. Smith alluded to with respect to the way that the licenses were given to providers. As he referenced, the two original cellular incumbents were awarded the licenses, and it was done via a lottery basis. There was no cash that was paid to acquire those licenses, or if there was any cash paid, it was very minimal. The FCC has determined to help with the federal budget issues that they are now auctioning spectrum, and that's where you've had a whole new cast of characters that have come into play to format competition within the wireless industry. But the FCC did auction those licenses, and that's where I think Oregon was faced with inequity within the wireless industry itself of valuing incumbent cellulars who did not have a book cost associated with their FCC licenses and valuing these new PCS providers that did have a book cost. That's one of the issues that we're trying to resolve with this particular exclusion. And I think one of the reasons that this makes a good start on trying to wrestle with the intangible debate is because of the current inequity that exists within the industry, but also because we are probably the only state-assessed company with respect to the state-assessed industry within that category who actually has the value of their operating right within the state independently assessed on a market basis and added back to the cost approach. That is not done for the wireline companies. That is not done for the airlines. That is not done for the railroads. And that was to address the inequities between the wireless providers that you had operating within the state.
Well, it seems to me that the solution to that problem is the Department of Revenue assessing them on a consistent basis
in
terms of determining the intangible value of the license, not what you paid for the license, but what the market-based value of the license is off of revenues or off of earnings.
That is what the state did do to cure the inequity between the wireless providers. The problem is they do not do that for the wireline companies. Their monopolistic franchise or the railroad's monopolistic franchise or airlines, a good example is their gate use agreements. The railroads have right-of-way contracts. Those are not independently valued and added under the cost approach and assessed to them under the current assessment practices. This is a unique situation that is applied to the wireless industry only at this point in time. And that is why we are seeking this legislation. And it is our corporate policy to support a broader intangibles bill because of these issues that you get into, the different stages that companies entered into, the current businesses that are state assessed, do present different complexities to how you value those companies. But I don't think it was ever more evident than with the case of the wireless providers, where you had one segment that did not pay anything for their existing licenses and another segment that did pay quite a bit of value to operate within the state.
Okay. Did you have some prepared testimony you wanted to give?
I'll just go through it again and again. Please. To for the record, my name is Stacy Sprinkle and I'm the Director of Federal and State Tax Policy for Verizon Wireless. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today to express my company's support for House Bill 2778. I think as we've denoted through some of the conversations that the wireless industry feels that there was an extreme disadvantage to it with respect to how its property was being valued because of the complexities presented based upon the FCC license issue. And we definitely appreciate this committee's consideration of a bill that would eliminate that current problem. As I also mentioned, it is our corporate philosophy to pursue a broader intangibles exclusion for all state-assessed property just because of the changing dynamics in the marketplace today. I know you are going to have the issue as to whether or not this presents a competitive advantage for the wireless industry over other telecommunications companies, and hopefully I've given you some background to be able to address what that issue is and why the wireless industry is pursuing this type of exclusion. One other aspect is that I know it's on all lawmakers' agendas these days to try to eliminate the digital divide, and I think more importantly is that wireless access in rural areas is going to be extremely important to accomplishing that goal. I think to continue to tax the value of FCC licenses is going to present a competitive barrier to entry that might not bring the rapid deployment of advanced telecommunications out to those areas. The other issue that we had was with respect to the calculation of the current fiscal note, and it is the industry's desire to try to sit down with the individuals at the Department of Revenue and provide whatever assistance necessary in ensuring that the fiscal note is an accurate measure of what this bill would do to the current tax base in the state of Oregon.
Let me just ask on that point. This is the first we've seen of the numbers that we got today. Had you seen these before? When did you first see these?
Yesterday.
So I guess is your testimony then that you don't necessarily accept the accuracy of these numbers?
I wouldn't say that. I would say that we had probably the same question that I know Jim tried to address in his testimony, which was that it had gone up substantially over the last 2 years, given that the first year of the expiration of the informal agreement that Mr. Conkling alluded to, we would want to go back and just address with each company's particular situation where they actually fell within the real market value and the market assessed value under Measure 50 to ensure that the numbers that were developed are accurate.
Right. Okay.
But we have not had a chance to analyze that to opine one way or the other.
Please continue.
That was really the end of my prepared remarks. And again, just wanted to thank you for the opportunity to express our company's support and urge this committee in providing a favorable recommendation for this House bill.
Any other questions for Ms. Sprinkle? All right. Thank you very much. Roger Martin.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin. I'm the lobbyist for Alaska Airlines, and because of their representation of the American Transit, the Air Aviation Alliance, which is ATA, Air Transportation Association, I represent the views of a number of other airlines. I've also been a participant since the very beginning in this argument, which outlasts every one of your tenure on intangible taxes. The airlines don't stand to gain anything from House Bill 2778. We're not here screaming our opposition, but I would like to take a few minutes to talk about the Oregon tax system. And I come not to criticize the Department of Revenue, because I think Jim Mineri is one of the better people I've ever dealt with in state government. And they simply follow a tax policy that is set by you, the legislature, and the governor. And from the viewpoint of the airlines of the United States, the tax policy of the state of Oregon sucks. And I'd like to give you some background.
I want to clarify here.
I could use some other terms, but I won't. In this particular argument we're talking about, we are not, I emphasize, the airlines are not in any way licensed by either the federal government or controlled by the PUC Commission, and we're in a totally free market system and have been in a very fierce competitive situation, not only with other airlines, but with other forms of transportation. And yet we are captured under this overall thing. And the previous people testified about as if there were just two kinds of people, those that are covered by the wireless and the FCC, and then those that are covered by the PUC Commission in Oregon. We're not. But we find ourselves taxed under what is, in our opinion, a very unfair tax system. And just so you understand it, we are taxed on things such as the gates at PDX. And since Alaska Airlines and its subsidiary Horizon represent about 45% of all the flights and the passenger miles in Oregon, we are the largest airline from a taxation standpoint. And we pay, and for your background, I checked this morning with the Department of Revenue, the assessed value of all 24 airlines that fall under their category of air transportation is $954 million. And our approximate taxes, because they can't give me that figure, it's confidential information, we approximately pay $15 million in property taxes, of which probably the intangible tax represents about $1 million. And we find that a very unfair tax. We find it one that ought to be done away with, and yet we find ourselves in this circumstance that where the governor has said who his favorites are and who they aren't, and I apparently fall in the category we're not. And it irritates me because I was one of those that worked very carefully after the 97 session with the governor in every way possible. I argued with some of my colleagues not to get in an argument with the governor when he vetoed the bill in 1997, because let's be patient. And our reward was another veto. And I suppose maybe that's what the threat is again, but I'd like somebody, and I believe, Mr. Chairman, the name of this committee is Tax Fairness.
Yes.
among other things.
It's in the name.
I'd like to talk about tax fairness, because I want somebody to explain to me what's fair about the tax we now pay. Some might say, you're paying $15 million, well, you ought to. Look at the airport you get to fly into. I want to make sure all of you understand something. The Portland International Airport and the other airports in Oregon are not paid for by property taxes. Every single penny needed to build and expand that airport comes from landing fees, passenger fees that are paid by you as passengers that fly, and parking fees. Nothing comes from the property tax. The Port of Portland gains about 2% of its entire budget from a property tax. So we're paying property tax to other entities, other forms of government. The unfairness of the overall tax system, and you should know, we have an ongoing argument now with the Department of Revenue about valuations of planes that are no longer in existence. Planes that we had in our fleets in 1989, 90, and 91, we're still arguing with them about what the value should be. And Mr. Maneri has attempted to help us in this, but it's an ongoing confounding problem, and I have had the opportunity to meet with the representatives from every one of the major airlines that have come into Oregon from all over the nation to meet with the tax people to try to come up with a solution. Our problem is not only the Department of Revenue and rather inflexible rules, it's also the Department of Justice in this state. I think you ought to understand what happens when you get sued by a government entity. Alaska Airlines just settled a case because they didn't have any choice but to settle it against the Department of Revenue, because the Department of Justice subpoenaed 20,000 documents and demanded a personal interrogation subpoena with the chief executive officer of Alaska Airlines, who was not even with the airlines during the period of time we're talking about. And our attorneys just said, we can't do it. The costs are too high. So we were bludgeoned into a settlement, which we disagree with. Overall, the airlines feel that this state, the state of Oregon, has the highest tax system of any state that uses the unitary system in the United States. That's 36 states. We're the highest. We're way high. And our intangible portion is extremely high. And it's something that we see nobody trying to make any, you know, effect on. I want to just talk about this committee and the policies you set. Last session you passed a bill, if you remember, part of the transportation package, all of which died except for the bill you passed. You doubled the tax on jet fuel. It's only a penny a year. 1 cent, I mean 1 cent a gallon, 1 cent a gallon. That raises $2 million in the state of Oregon. Now, I want you to think for a minute about value received for what you pay. We pay $2 million of jet fuel tax. You know how much money has gone to any airport in the state of Oregon from the new Department of Aviation towards anything to provide any service? Not one penny. All that money has been spent somewhere else. So we do have a mat on about the tax policies that you're setting. And we're just trying to figure, you know, where does some relief come from? Where is this fairness doctrine we're talking about? Now, there's a direct correlation to what happens in the treatment of the airlines. And no, I talked to Delta Airlines, and they did not pull their trip to the Orient because of our tax policy. They pulled it for a very simple reason. Unfortunately, we're not supplying enough passengers, either collectively in the United States or from the state of Oregon, from a business standpoint, to sustain daily flights or three times a week flights to Japan. That's why we lost that. But what the effect is that each time an airline, and this is a specific example from Delta, each time an airline buys a new plane, a new 757, a new 767, that are the new passenger-friendly planes, they take a look at what routes they're going to put those planes on, and one of the factors they consider is the tax system in which they're going to put that plane. And if that new plane costs what those new planes cost, they're not going to fly it into Oregon. They're going to fly it to San Francisco or some other place because we have the highest tax policy, and they're not going to pay that higher tax when they can fly their older planes in here. Now, the ultimate irony of all of this is that if we talk about the tax policy, and you asked the question, Representative Bates, of why the governor vetoed it last time. Basically, he vetoed it because local government came in here and screamed about the revenue they were going to lose. I'd love to have him come up and justify why we ought to pay this tax, but I can perhaps understand. But one of the loudest complainers was the city of Portland, who has joined now with the Port of Portland in seeking a new airline to fly in and provide international traffic in and out of PDX into a state where they where they sustain and support the highest tax policies. Now, I don't suppose I'm going to have any effect on all of this because it seems to be a grease skid that this bill is going down. But I hope once in a while, somewhere along the line, you can get down to talking about fairness for all of us, including the utilities, who cannot readily pass on this tax that they're now paying. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the opportunity to let loose on you.
Representative Williams, you're first.
Well, I just want to first say, Roger, I appreciate you making this an interesting hearing. Because I was starting to nod off the table. And secondly, I'm still trying to figure out if there's a single person in this room you haven't yet offended by your comments here today.
Mr. Chairman, let me respond to that. And Representative Williams, my daughter and granddaughter are here from California. They don't really care what the policy is here.
Oh, well,
they're not offended.
Good job. Good job. Yeah, okay, I was just really commenting. It was very interesting comments. Thanks.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Roger, I think a little bit of fairness is needed here to the legislature, which I believe in 1997 and 1999
yes.
passed bills in both the House and the Senate that basically said the intangible taxes should be done away with because they are competitively disadvantageous to the state and unfair to those businesses that have to pay them. Would you mind giving us that credit, please?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Witt, you're exactly right. The legislature has done it, and you do deserve the credit, and I suppose I was passing my comments on, I'm trying now to be the historian since institutional memory is slipping. I'm trying to supply some of that for the newer members of this committee. You're correct, and I guess my point is really addressed to the second floor in the middle, not to the House and Senate.
I appreciate that clarification, because you did say that we have the highest tax system in referring to this, and nobody's doing anything about it. In fact, we worked along with you and the rest of the team pretty hard this last session, the last two sessions. In terms of fairness, Roger, I guess I would ask you to respond to this. I understand the image I have is the fellow who's just discovered that there aren't enough lifeboats on the Titanic for everybody, so nobody should get off.
Gotcha. I don't know.
Is that your definition of fairness?
I'm going to jump. I'm not going to get into deciding.
Questions anymore? Okay, Roger, I want to thank you.
Thank you, Representative,
for making our hearing interesting. We've probably got some more interesting testimony coming now from the local government folk. Why don't we bring up the foursome, the fearsome foursome of Commissioner McClure, Gil Riddell, Michelle Dyster, and Hasina Squires. Come on up. We got room at the table.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Michelle Dyster with the League of Oregon Cities. In 1995, 97, and again in 99, as has been discussed, bills for exempting the intangible personal property of centrally assessed industries were before the Oregon legislature. These bills provided multi-million dollar tax exemptions to utilities, telecommunications companies, airlines, railroads, and other companies that operate as a unit in more than one county and more than one state. The financial impact of this exemption was estimated by the Legislative Revenue Office at that time to be between $30.5 and $61.8 million over a three-year period. The League of Oregon Cities opposed that legislation because it resulted in an increased tax burden on residential taxpayers. The beneficiaries had already received a disproportionate share of tax relief under Measure 5, and it reduced funding for local services and schools, and the exemption promised no direct benefit to Oregon consumers in this state. So the League of Oregon City's position on the issue of general intangibles, such as what Mr. Martin has been discussing, has not changed. The bill before you today represents an exception to the intangibles issue to correct what is perceived to be an inequity among the same class of taxpayers. The differences in how certain telecommunications providers receive their FCC licenses results in a difference in how they are assessed under Measure 50. It is our understanding that this bill is only supposed to apply to the wireless telecommunications sector, and we're concerned that this bill could be broadly interpreted to include other sectors receiving FCC licenses. So we would appreciate language that clarifies this particular point. We recognize that this committee will be considering many property tax exemptions, abatements, and special assessments over the course of the coming months, and all of these bills have a local revenue impact. Due to the passage of property tax limitation measures 5 and 50, the amount of revenue that local governments can raise through property tax assessments is strictly limited by the Constitution. It is not possible to increase tax rates to offset the revenue losses resulting from property tax exemptions. These revenues support local services such as public safety, water, sewer, roads, parks, libraries, and schools. So we urge you not to approve any additional property tax exemptions this session.
Thank you, Michelle. Any questions? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Michelle, I'd like to try to explain a couple statements that you made because I'm having trouble with them. One is you said that the bill last session, if it had passed, would have raised taxes on residential taxpayers. And you also said that the beneficiaries of that bill, the centrally assessed utilities, had already received a disproportionate share of tax relief. Could you explain both of those statements to me?
Madam Chair, Representative Witt, generally speaking, under Measure 5, as Mr. Maneri basically explained, when you talk about Measure 5 and 50, what Measure 50 did is it requires the local, the that's the word I'm looking for, the real market value, it's the lower of the real market value or the assessed value. And because of the differences in commercial industries, what you see, generally speaking, is that they are able to keep their real market value steady.
Well, isn't that because the real market value hasn't gone up nearly to the degree of as residential property?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Representative Witt, basically...
In other words, wasn't it market conditions that created this, what you call, disproportionate share of benefit?
Madam Chair, I might be able to help a little bit. Representative Witt, I can... Yes, for the record, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. I will provide for you a sheet that we had as an exhibit last, both last session, I think the session before. It has to do with certain utilities and the benefits for Measure 5. I don't have it by memory. It's not before me, but I can bring that into you.
No, my concern here is that this is being expressed in this testimony in such a way that it's ignoring the fact that it's the way what has happened to real market values, which has determined what the benefit has been under Measure 50. So if you have a property or a class of property where the real market value has gone up a whole lot, the amount that's taxable or how you assess the tax was limited by Measure 50, so it's significantly below Measure 5. The reality of it is the reason there's been more, appears to be more relief to business as opposed to residential users under Measure 50 is because the residential property real market value went up at a much faster pace. So it's not like Measure 50 was directed to give this disproportionate share of benefit to business. But could you also comment on raises taxes on residential users? I don't see where this bill or the bill from 1999 in any way raised taxes on residential property, what you call here residential taxpayers. Can you explain to me how it does that?
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair,
yeah, there,
you are back.
Great.
I did see that. I thought I saw you sneak in here. Representative Witt, basically in those communities where there is a local option, because you cannot increase because tax rates cannot be increased, what can happen, and that's not to say that it always does, is that local governments may seek local options to replace some revenues that are lost to property tax exemptions.
Okay, but that's a decision of local taxpayers. Passage of this bill or passage of the bill in 1999, I don't believe in any way increased property taxes on residential property owners. Isn't that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, as I said, that is something that can happen.
Yeah, no, but I'd appreciate it if you'd... I'd like clarification, because it said here that it resulted in an increased tax burden on residential taxpayers. And if you could tell me where in the language it does that or where in the 99 bill it did that, I would appreciate that.
And I believe I do have some data that supports that statement back in my office, which I'll be happy to share with you.
You don't want to see it?
I'll be happy to see the data, but I'd like to see in the bill where it does it.
Who's next?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Steve McClure, Union County Commissioner and President of the Association of Oregon Counties. The bill you're considering today, 2778, gives me an opportunity to bring up to your attention some laws that were passed in the last session, and those are ORS 306.350 and 306.359. Those statutes provided that if the legislature provided property tax exemptions...
If you could back away a little bit from that sensitive microphone, thank you.
Provided an opportunity that if the legislature provided those exemptions, that there was a course of action that needed to be followed. And a couple of things that could happen. As you know, property taxes are resources for local government. And what is provided in this bill is an opportunity for funding up to 50% of those exemptions in a fund that's set aside to reimburse local governments for those funds, or it allows for the opportunity for other exemptions to be done away with so that local government nearly remains whole in this whole process. The fund has been set up, there's $1 in it, there's nothing been put in it to address that. And I guess what we're asking today is that you give that consideration as you go forward to those statutes that are in place, and we would suggest there are probably three ways that you can address that. The first being not to give exemptions. The second would be to go to Ways and Means if you pass these out and ask that there be funding placed in it for these exemptions. Or third, identify other exemptions that can be done away with to compensate the local governments for those positions. I want to thank you for consideration, and we would certainly take any questions that you have.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Steve, the property tax expenditure fund, which you're referring to, does the statute say that for that trigger to kick in, to pay half of the value of any property tax reduction, that the legislature has to affirmatively appropriate that money into the fund? And is that a discretionary judgment on the part of the legislature?
Mr. Chair, Representative White, yes, it is. And we are asking you to address that in this situation. It's a question of fairness. You know, we in local government are bearing the burden of some of these things, and we understand that a lot of times it's a policy issue that you as legislators need to address. We're just asking that you make that consideration, and it's not 100% reimbursement. It's a 50% reimbursement, and that as you go through these policy considerations, you consider the impacts on local government and help us address those.
So you're saying you're asking us to exercise discretion that we would have in terms of appropriating money into that fund to cover 50% of the lost revenues?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, just a further clarification, Gil Riddell, for the record. That particular series of statutes isn't effective until July 1 this year, but will likely be effective for many of these provisions that you're considering. And it does use the word shall. What it says, however, is that if you don't have money in the fund, you can't go into debt to pay it. But it's a little bit stronger than just a may kind of discretion. It says that the state legislature shall do this. Now, if you don't have money in the fund, the state won't go into debt. But the word shall is used.
Okay, if I can follow up on that. Gail, do you agree with Commissioner McClure's analysis here, though, that even though it uses the word shall, it's discretionary for the legislature to direct money into the fund or not?
I do agree with that, Mr. Chair.
Well, I think, and I'm looking at the statute here, what it says is that 50% of the lost revenues shall be funded by amounts appropriated to the property tax expenditure funding account. And I guess the discretionary aspect is what is appropriated to the property tax expenditure funding account. That's the issue.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Do both of you agree that there would not be a legal cause of action against the state if the legislature did not appropriate money into that fund?
Mr. Chair, I speak for both of us. Yes, there would not be a cause of action.
Well, Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I asked a question earlier of Mr. Conkling about impact to schools. There's also an impact to counties, as you've expressed in your testimony, and to cities as well. And putting aside the value of tax policy and so forth, and maybe just sort of in a nutshell, my understanding is that, having worked with counties, the counties have experienced revenue declines over the last several years, and this impacts correction services, health services, mental health services, and so forth at the county level. I'm not being on a steep learning curve, I guess, in terms of the intricacies of property taxes and how it affects it. Are these types of revenue impacts that we see on this sheet, do those affect those services directly? And could you just speak to that briefly for me?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, yes, they do. The last couple of weeks I've been under testifying, and it seems like I'm testifying on these same measures on several different fronts. It's reduction of fees. It's for changing the limit on personal property. And a lot of times they're not big cuts, you know. I mean, if you look at them in the context of a $2 billion that counties spend for services, no, they're not big cuts, but it's just the little pieces. It's the president's. And we certainly understand that you as legislators have some policy issues to deal with. And I sit and listen to some of those, and I'm very sympathetic. But the challenge to me as a local official is I'm charged with providing services for the people of the state of Oregon. And when those revenues go away, it becomes very difficult for us to do that. Ballot Measure 5, Ballot Measure 4750 have certainly limited our ability to do that, to go out and find those revenues. It becomes a very serious challenge. So a lot of times I know when we're down here talking about them, you think, well, you know, we're talking small sums of money. But you accumulate it over the process of the legislative session, they can have some significant impacts. And we're talking about services like the sheriffs, jails, some very basic services that have to be provided for the community. It's not like these services, if we don't provide them, aren't going to have to be provided, because they're going to have to be provided. I think the classic example is voting. Counties run the voting systems for the state of Oregon. We run them for the state elections, local elections, and federal elections, and we certainly know what those impacts can be if we don't fund those in a proper level. So yes, they do have. Each one might not be a big impact, but combined they do become a problem for us.
Yes.
My second question is related. I saw a piece of information that our local Chamber of Commerce put together that applies to cities, but I think that it's a relevant concept to counties as well, and that is that the state has, in terms of pass-through money to counties for programs, has sort of ratcheted that down over the years as well, and that actually the City of Salem right now is looking at some budget shortfalls, but the amount of the budget shortfall that's projected is about equal to the amount of pass-through money that's been cut over the years. So is there any truth to the perception that the pass-through money from the state to fund services in terms of that partnership, that state-local partnership, have been diminished over the last, say, 10 years?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, yes, there has been, and I can give you some concrete examples. I think the problem that we have when we deal in comparison with state agencies, agency budgets provide for continuing service level. You know, there's roll-ups and everything else. A lot of the funding sources that we get at counties and cities, there's none of that kind of provision. I think the classic example from our perspective is DA funding. The state has basically funded DAs nearly level for a number of years. Historically, the state's contribution has been close to 20% or a little bit greater. Currently, 9% of DA funding is provided by the state. Grants and localities provide the rest of that funding. So yes, we see those kinds of changing in proportionality with state fundings in a lot of different programs.
Thank you very much. Hasina, do you want to come on up? I'll let you back clean up.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I wonder if they're all leaving because they think I'm going to start screaming. Because I haven't heard anybody scream yet, and I'm the last one here. So I think maybe it was just Roger that was screaming because I'm not planning on doing that. For the record, my name is Hosina Squires. I'm here today representing the Special Districts Association of Oregon. I want to start out by pointing out that I think that we're on House Bill 2778 and that it talks about FCC license property or tax exemptions, not all intangible tax exemptions. And that's what I'm here to speak to. I feel like all of a sudden the whole room has erupted into all intangibles, and I'm prepared to talk about the FCC license exemption tax. That's the only bill that I have a revenue impact or a fiscal impact on in front of me, so I wanted to clarify that. I just want to briefly explain for the benefit of the committee that the Special Districts Association has a very diverse membership, and Representative Carlson, when you talk about impacts to services and revenue losses, special districts are a little different type of animal from cities and counties. We're single service providers. We provide services like sanitary sewer service, water, irrigation districts, port districts, fire districts, 911 districts, just a whole host of services. The main difference between cities and counties and special districts is that, and I hate to bring up a sore subject, Representative Shetterly or for Michelle or Gill back there, but we don't receive state shared revenue. We don't receive cigarette or liquor tax. Our main source of funding comes mainly from property tax revenue and also from fees and charges. With one exception, the 911 tax, we do receive a distribution from that. But really, state funding for special service districts is pretty non-existent. And frankly, we have liked it that way in the past. That way we don't have to come in here and argue about keeping it. So really, our association is always very concerned when property tax exemptions are proposed. Those services, since we're single service providers, those services that we provide, we don't have the option of shifting the cut from the library department to the police department to what is it we're going to cut. We have no choice. We just must operate with less revenue and continue to try to provide the same high quality level of service. So I just wanted to point that out. And the other thing is, I think I heard Gary Conkling address your question, Representative Carlson, about the school funding issue, and that the legislature, since they're in session, has the opportunity to deal with the school funding, and I assume he meant by backfilling the school fund. But you also have that opportunity in ORS 306-353 with the 50% distribution allocation that could be made into that property tax account, and we strongly urge you to do so if you do choose to pass this legislation.
Okay. Thank you very much. All right. Anybody else here who just feels inspired to testify as a result of the goings on? We've finished our sign-up sheet. Committee members, we will conclude the public hearing on this. I want to thank everybody for an interesting public hearing on this today. Certainly lots to talk about and consider. We will be done for today, though. That concludes our business, and we are...